challenged by that as well, sexism sometimes. So the first half of the talk is going to be a bit more formal, and then I'll open it up.
Do you mind just speaking up just slightly?
Okay.
That would be great.
By the 1920s in North America, anti-architecture was being promoted in the museum profession. Anti-architecture marked itself in opposition to galleries which were designed to allude to the architecture of the nobility. The allusions to temples or palaces was viewed as anachronistic. Art directors such as Gilman argued that buildings of this type threatened to overwhelm the art object. Architecture's explicitly representational forms were repressed in order to heighten its abstract play of forms. This repression of explicit ornament resulted in a re-articulation of ornament. Architecture's representational status was maintained as it was used to provide a suitable image of neutrality and, in, by extension, autonomy. So there's this connection between the value of aesthetic value of autonomy in art and in architecture. Architecture was used as a powerful component in the scripting of neutrality. Through its re-articulation of ornament, the white cube provided a representation of the desired autonomy of the art object it framed. And so I'm arguing that just as in earlier forms of architecture where there was an intimate dialogue between architecture, its ornament, the narratives embodied in it, and the two-dimensional elements in the interior, within the modernist gallery, there's also this intimate dialogue between the art object and the architecture that frames it. The unity that I would argue is occurring in the White Cube Gallery is the tendency for both architecture during this period and art to utilise the strategy of negation. So the modernist White Cube is formed through its negation of previous solutions for gallery design, just as certain forms of abstract art are formed through a negation of representational and figurative art forms. So there's this kind of echoing between the artwork and its architectural frame. So thinking of someone like Ed Reinhardt's work in particular, relationship to the White Cube Gallery, we see this kind of intimate dialogue between the two. Alfred Bard, the director of MoMA, promoted formalist analysis of art during the 1930s. Bard's rigorous catalogues privileged the formal qualities of the artworks examined, unpacking their stylistic influences. Bard was less vocal when it came to providing the social and political context for art. The emphasis on the formal aspects of the artwork is reinforced by the White Cube, and therefore it is inherently political as a representation of neutrality. The aesthetics of the White Cube serve to present that there is an illusion between aesthetics and politics. So now moving through to the kind of counter-argument to this position. In his landmark text, Inside the White Cube, written by Brian O'Doherty, he outlined an early critique of the idea that the White Cube Gallery was neutral. His particular descriptions of the White Cube provided a seductive stereotype of the White Cube. Through his influential descriptions, O'Doherty is as much architect of the White Cube as directors as Gilman and Barr, and argue that his descriptions romanticise the modernist gallery and exaggerate its purity. I think that artists who were providing institutional technique are often tapping into this romanticised image of the modernist gallery, and perhaps how it often was. For example, I don't describe certain conventions in the white and the modernist gallery, such as the absence of carpet, etc. But when we look at modernist galleries from the period, often there is carpet, and there are some kind of subtle references to domestic architecture. O'Doherty describes the white cube as a hermetic space which resists acknowledgement of its context. The appeal to timelessness negates the reality of the corporeal body and the provisional nature of any representation of the nature of reality posited by the artworks the gallery contains. The construction of the white cube as a representation of neutrality was a significant product of Western formalism. The intensification of aesthetic experience provided by the white cube provides a representation of the aura of the art object. The necessity of an architectural aura to compensate for a lack in the artwork counters the idea that meaning springs forth from the artwork. The meaning effect provided by the gallery locates the meaning within the art object's relationships to its architectural frame. The architectural frame shifts from a representation of neutrality once the work frame relationship is rethought by conceptual artists during the 1960s and 70s. And now I'm just going to show a number of indicative examples which relate to, well, provide a critique of the institution of the art gallery for a number of different strategies which foreground particular dimensions of the gallery. So in the kind of earlier critiques, often there's this kind of attentiveness to the gallery's physical space, making you kind of aware of its materiality, its physical properties, and how it's influencing your perception and appreciation of the art object. And obviously there's a reference to work in this session. Another example of this kind of approach where the measurements are taken. Varenne's work is playing with that kind of the way that the gallery shifts the meaning and our ability to aesthetically experience an object within the space, obviously closely related to Duchamp's strategies. And then there's a movement to relating the art gallery and the processes that occur within it to other institutions and processes. So you've got this expansion of the frame of reference. And of course, with feminism, the social dimensions are foreground. So I've provided a very sweeping frame foundation and framework for the next stage. And I'm basically saying that the artists in this exhibition are in dialogue with this tradition, but their deployment of the strategies is for different reasons, and the significance of the works in this exhibition can't be understood if we read them as a pure continuation of the legacy embodied in these artists' work. And I think to understand and comprehend the significance of the work in this exhibition, we need to extend our understanding of what it means to address sight. And I think that we need to extend sight to include the conceptual and philosophical situating of a problem in question. So we're bringing in the idea of discourse, not just the gallery as a physical space and as an institution. And although the works within the exhibition may address sight as a concrete location, sight is concurrently understood and explored as a multi-layered construct operating on planes as diverse as the spatial, temporal, historical, political and social control. We need to situate these works within these diverse frames of reference in order to comprehend both the way that the strategies are utilised and how meaning is activated by the artworks. And this brings me to the next section of the talk tonight, where I'm going to discuss a specific case study which connects to research I've been doing on this idea of activating latent cultural content within a site. And it's a work by an Austrian architect who's also a sculptor, and he came to prominence during the 1960s as an avant-garde artist. He was a performance artist, he later started making site-specific sculptures, and he was very frustrated about the conventional relationships between sculpture and the buildings which encase them. So he started producing buildings for his own sculptures within a specific site, St. Martin's in Austria, Bungerland. And I think he's useful in relationship to this talk because he's setting up the idea that the artwork and the architectural frame are an intimate dialogue with one another. They're kind of dependent on one another, and they both are expressing their relationship to sight, but through different mechanisms and through the possibilities available through the shifts of scale and the shifts of discipline. So I'm going to unpack this particular work and then relate what's happening in this piece to the works within this exhibition. Origin of the project. In 1994, Pischler's cousin, the artist and architect, is Walter Pischler. His cousin commissioned this house, which is next to their grandfather's blacksmith workshop. When the smithy was being restored and was under a recent conservation order, the client's father, Pischler's uncle Eugene, was the artist. Pischler's uncle Eugene was the last blacksmith to have worked in the smithy. The smithy is no longer used and now functions as a historic record of the family's presence on the site, rather than as a utilitarian structure. The house was designed as a short-term accommodation for Pischler's friends and family. So this is the smithy, and this is the building next to it. They are in close proximity, and in a certain sense, the new building is a translation and reinterpretation of this one. In 2002, Pischler wrote an account of his relationship to the site of the building, which is located within the Egental Valley in South Trieste, Italy. His family left the valley in 1941, prompted by the Hitler-Mussolini Accord, and immigrated to North Trieste. Pischler was 5 years old and later recalled both his and his mother's distress as they were forced to leave the valley. He returned to the valley on various occasions as a child and remembers the old smithy affectionately. His stated aim for the project was to place memory on an equal footing as solid material. Memory is intended to transform the past rather than to simply recall it. The building represents Pischler's relationship to the site, setting up a dialogue with both the original memory and the smithy itself. The central importance of memory within this project connects to his broader practice as a sculptor and architect. Since the 1970s, Pischler has created site-specific sculptures and buildings to house him within his farm in St. Martin in Bungerland, Austria. He consistently attempts to create an intimate dialogue between the sculptures and the site within which they are located. The formal language of his architecture is dominated by moments of either resisting or merging with the ground.
Just use the arrow key from you now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's right.
I had that for So the binary of this building, the interior of this building operates with a fundamental binary. The house next to the smithy contains two floors, one above ground containing living quarters, and one below ground containing a wine cellar. These are linked by a semi-submerged corridor, which is capped by foundation stones. The design has a diagrammatic clarity that is complicated by Pushler's emphasis on cycles and flows between steps. There are no penetrations in the wall of the house. The building is double-skinned, with a row of unmortared coping stones placed over the gap between these layers. In order to reach the cellar, one must progress. That's with the soda.
Maybe it's a space bar.
Space bar. In order to reach the cellar, one must progress through a trap door, and then navigate a narrow corridor. It's just space bar.
Stops in the same place. I think it's a software for it. Somebody set up timing on the slides.
Is it okay if we just keep flicking back?
Backwards and forwards.
Really realizing this. Yeah.
Sorry about this. It's kind of heavy and strobing. In order to reach the cellar, one must progress through a trapdoor and then navigate a narrow corridor surmounted by the monumental boulders sourced from the nearby river. So in the kind of slightly ambiguous forms at the top of the corridor are the stones themselves. This heightens awareness of the progression into subterranean space. The foundation rocks establish hierarchical importance to this space. The corridor is a space of movement between thresholds. The space speaks of a transition in multiple terms, most obviously from terrain to subterranean space and light to dark, but the space also resounds existentially as a rehearsal of the subject's eventual merging to the primordial ground. The architect worked closely with the photographer of the work, so these are quite a deliberate narrative constructed through these images. Hopefully it doesn't do that for the whole thing. So this is the cellar phone. Conflicting signs dominate Pushler's poetics. The negative cultural projections upon dark space are alluded to alongside imagery which refers to the privileged insight of the melancholic. The outer walls of the corridor envelop the cellar, which lies completely beneath the ground, totally submerged. Its spatial qualities are highly evocative of the anxiety that Antony Vidler identifies with dark space. In his eponymous essay, Vidler summarized the association of light and dark space in context of the Enlightenment. During the Enlightenment, the primary identification with light and dark space was moral. Light spaces were aligned with the health of the individual, and by extension, the social body. Light released society from the dark forces of myth and folklore. Dark space, in contrast, was aligned with the pathological, the unseen, and the diseased agent that would harm the social body. Countering the Enlightenment connection between light and access to truth is a historic connection between melancholia and insight. Darkness structures a melancholic's encounter with the world through his or her sensitivity to the opacity of representation. In her essay on Pushler, Diane Lewis tied him to the tradition of darkness rather than light. She suggests that the visible is an unreliable source of information, and that there is a deeper structure that would be more accessible with either the removal or the repression of the visible. The melancholic is conscious of the impossibility of objective knowledge of the appearance of the world, in response to the resulting descent into the abyss of subjectivism and relativism, the melancholic reconceptualizes the material world as a mask. So at this point we think about why the architect has chosen to shut him off from this kind of incredibly beautiful landscape. It's making him aware of these other levels of meaning within this space. Krishna has constructed a space for perception through the repression of the visible. His deniers of views of the landscape and the extensive use of dark space are significant in this context, as he attempts to transcend an ocular-centric experience of landscape. This highly internalized spatial condition is one of the strategies he uses to re-articulate sight as ground. The specific qualities of sight are exchanged for the abstract experience of time and duration provided by various cycles, including the cycle from light to darkness of the seasons, and the longer life cycle evident in the physical breakdown and decay of our bodies as we age. We experience history through atmosphere. The exaggeration of weather in Pishva's building foregrounds the experience of time within the interior. Weather is received rather than resisted by the building. Rain falls between the coping stones, which were over that corridor space, before seeping back to the river. The gentleness, rain falls from that roof into a catchment pool at the base of the chimney, and then it mounts and then flows back down to the river. So there's this real exaggeration of weather and the passing of time, and weather is used as dramatically as an image to communicate this kind of content about this kind of fundamental level of experience of the sight. And in the earlier image, there's also kind of complex patterns formed by the roof shape, so you get this real dramatization as the through fluctuations of light, you get kind of complex patterns being formed and dissolved through the space. Which goes to this other thread of layer in the work, which is to do with fallen nature, a term that Walter Benjamin utilised. In architects' drawings, the ground plane is often represented as a thin line with blank space beneath it. Pishla represents the ground as a dense and motively loaded substance in tension with architecture through building design and drawing. He alludes to traditions that attribute authenticity to the ground, both Christian and pagan, and to the imagery of the symbolist poets who viewed nature as an empty husk. This image on your right is from a book of poetry by Baudelaire, which Benjamin used within his own. And I think this has a kind of similarity to Pushler's work. We get this same kind of melancholic kind of depiction of the body and landscape. So in the drawn representation of the project, Pushler is representing a specific cultural understanding of landscape, which is tied to the concept of ground as origin. Stone is an emblem of permanence. Pushler counters this association by representing this building with a skeletal figure within the landscape in order to allude to the emblematic role of this building as a sign of the human subject's inevitable submission to natural history. The figure in the foreground has a marked similarity to images of fallen nature produced during the 19th century. During this period, there was a large increase in atheism in the West, particularly amongst the intellectual classes. In the Christian theory of God, of nature, God was viewed as a creator of the natural world. The splendor of the natural world was seen as evidence of God's existence. Nature was therefore viewed as meaningful due to its connection to the creator. With the rise of atheism, artists began to represent nature as a ruin, as an entity that was absent of meaning. Withered landscapes mirrored the new understanding of death as final, rather than as a moment of transition to a heavenly realm. So think about this in connection to the house and how it's formed. The house is designed to rehearse the process of its eventual dissipation. It provides a representation of a post-mythic conception of death that disputes the possibility of transcendence. Lying semi-submerged in the ground, there is an obvious implication that the smithy is sinking. The walls extend out beyond the low pitch roof structure, establishing a hierarchical relationship between these elements. The roof is placed upon the walls, appearing to rest there as a temporary protective element. The expressed gap between them suggests a moment of transition prior to roof failure when the wall as ruin remains. The oblique elevation of the house in Smithy expresses the significance of the building entrance. The ancient walls form a semicircle that delineates the space in front of the building, while low-lying sinking walls suggest an archaeological remnant. These ancient walls are rendered with the same fragility as the smithy they reach towards. In contrast to the more clearly rendered house, the faintly drawn smithy suggests a process of erasure within which the historic smithy is in a more advanced stage. Paper absorbs the pigment, echoing the ground's absorption of the building. Pishler re-articulates site as ground by activating the latent cultural associations of the site. Atmosphere is agent of change and the horizon through which conscious reflection on experience is enacted. Weather, light and soil are reconfigured through this architecture into emblems of transformation that tie the body to primordial ground. This knowledge haunts and threatens the architectural structures that we erect to immortalise ourselves. Although Pishler attempts to inscribe his biography in the landscape, he is conscious of the futility of such an act. The non-negotiable fact that both our constructions and ourselves will be erased as evidence in his representations. So, after the pause, so this reading of this building, I'm arguing, is kind of emblematic. In part, it's indebted to Walter Benjamin's kind of theory about the way that history is activated by the image. And when I've written the piece, it's in a certain sense kind of performing this kind of process of extraction, thinking about the kind of triggers within the work which activate these kind of strands of history and meaning. Now, I'm thinking about these kind of processes in relationship to this exhibition and how the artists have drawn on the art gallery as an institution and as a as an element within broader discussions which stem from our relationship to images and places, etc. So my fundamental interpretation of this exhibition is that the way that the artists are distinct from the earlier ones is that their work can't be reduced to a critique. I think that they're making references to this critique as part of this process of activating memory within a site. And I think that they're activating memory not only within this place, this gallery, but with the idea of the gallery in much more broad terms. So now I'm just going to talk about these ideas in relationship to specific examples in the exhibition. I'm relying on your knowledge of the works around the memory of your memory of the works within the show, and I'm bringing up images which relate to these pieces which will foreground certain dimensions of them. Connected to my response to the work is a show that was held at Art Space by a friend of mine, Stella Brennan, which was held in the late 90s, titled Nostalgia for the Future. And in some ways I think that's happening with some of the works of the show. Not every piece, but certainly with some of them, I think there's a sense of relating to a particular understanding of what the future means as a word and how it was utilised by the avant-garde. And there's a certain sense of disbelief in the possibility of visionary work or work which is somehow can emerge through a pure negation of previous forms or strategies. Connected to Daniel's work, which I'm about to bring up, is a kind of practice which was advocated by a theorist at Cambridge called Dalibor Vesely. He he taught architecture within, and he taught within the art history department as well. And he got his students in the architecture school to make metaphorical studies of spaces that they were designed for. So they would look to certain archetypical images which were emblematic of the program or the building type, and then they would design from that awareness. And thinking about what this kind of process happening within architecture schools and the kind of processes that are happening within artist work, probably not in this kind of systematic way, but in a much more intuitive way. So going to Daniel Malone's work, and I think his work is highly layered, and that it communicates in more than one level at once. At a certain level, it's replicating the strategies of the early conceptual artists. There's kind of a superficially, there's a connection between the appearance of the glass stack in Smithson's work and the kind of investment in human materials. And then within the film, again, superficially, there's a connection to the kind of imagery produced by artists like Solowit. But I think when it becomes more interesting when we start connecting this kind of incessant, almost obsessional referencing to the kind of imagery of the conceptual artists and the way that Daniel deploys biographical stories in relationship to this imagery. And in one of the videos, he discusses his journey to China, the way he stumbled across graffiti, and the graffiti he found out was saying destroy. So you get this kind of sense of his journey through the site, this place of sort of discovery. He then goes on to talk about his reluctance to engage with representing China through sociological frameworks, etc. And I was thinking about that kind of narrative drive and its connection to this kind of imagery. So Solowit has produced these kind of studies, but he also produced this kind of imagery, which he titled Autobiography. And I thought that was kind of interesting with Daniel's pieces. And I think this connects to Felix González Torres's work, where he was saying that basically that it was impossible for the minimalist to produce work which was purely autonomous, for its meaning to be wholly contained within the materiality of the object. González Torres argued that we always, whatever we encounter in the world, we relate to other objects we've encountered. So the minimalist work was always going to be coloured by our subjective impressions. And I think Daniel Malone's works operating in some ways like González Torres's work, there's a sense of this biography complicating and reorientating the meaning of the minimalist conceptual artworks he's referencing. Another work by González Torres, The Candy Stack, the weight of the stack is equal to his lover Ross. His lover died of AIDS. So there's this other layer of resonance with this piece. Again, an additional reference for Malone's work, and I think it's this point that the clarity of the difference between the people he's referring to and his own practice comes in. So I think with Gordon Matter Clark's work, I think the critique is very explicit. In some ways it's quite reductive. He was opposed to the principles of concerning architecture that he learned at Cornell. He was invited to participate in a project organised by his former teachers at Cornell, the Institute of Architecture and Urban Studies. He was invited to present a piece there, and he gave permission to shoot one window and display an image of the housing projects in the Bronx, which Matter Clark viewed as the negative. frustration hearing about, without permission, shooting every single window of the floor that the Institute was held. And while reportedly muttering obscenities about his former teachers. So I think this work, to me, is much more violent, its point is much more straightforward and clear than Malone's work seems quite tentative and highly aestheticised in comparison. And I think that the reference, the superficial reference to this kind of work is about his work being in dialogue with this history, and it's almost like it's this kind of core base which is always within his practice that he's incessantly referencing and re-referencing. So it's become part of his biography. And I think that's the way that he processes it. And it's this way of working that I link to Pishler's work. There's a sense that you have a site, you have a body of work, whether it's a piece of architecture or pre-existing artworks, and then there's this process of establishing a dialogue with them. So I think Malone and Pishler are connected at that level. Going through to another, probably my favourite work in the exhibition. This is where I risk mispronouncing the artist's name. Peter Trevelyan's work. Is that correct?
He's actually
with me. Which I thought is an incredibly exquisite work, and incredibly layered in its meaning. And I thought that this piece also is in operating through this kind of language of dialogue. It's kind of referencing the idea of the future as it was related to the avant-garde tradition. And I think this, the action of negation is even more interesting in relationship to communism when we think about the violence deployed within communism to crush bourgeois culture, the attempts to destroy the family unit, the attempt to deny private ownership, etc. So I think there's this interesting notion when we move beyond a model of negation, what that means for contemporary practice. I think that also this piece of thought is also quite beautiful, the kind of haunting quality of the piece in relationship to something which was so violent, and this there's even something about the nature of the meat and its kind of toxic nature with the idea of the system. It keeps going on and on and on with that work. And of course the relationship between paper architecture and the avant-garde is very strong, the kind of rhetorical role of work in that period. Different some of the technical pieces. And with that work I was also think of it in relationship to the appropriation artists like Sherry Levine, where you get the sense that the copy. Well, she's kind of combating Walter Benjamin's theory regarding the aura, that the copy undermines the original meaning of the meaning of the original work, and she's trying to move a copy which has a aura of its own, and is thinking of Trevelyan's work in that kind of context, that this work which is derived from the original builds upon it and offers something new. Are still indebted to that source. Which brings me to the last work I'll discuss, which is Fiona Connor's work, which I think has a very clear connection to this kind of piece, and that there's a sense that you're exposing the mechanisms of the gallery, the kind of concealed processes within the institution are revealed. But I think with conclusion is basically that there's a shift, as I observe it, is away from negation and critique to one of dialogue and discussion with this notion of form. Again, thank you.
Thank you. I guess maybe I'll start by feeding a question. How do you think the series of artist projects is also moving on from a kind of relational aspect? Or is it? Or what do you see the relationship?
I don't know a lot about relational aesthetics, I must confess.
Mm.
So it's a bit dangerous territory. Are you thinking of Cronus work in particular? In terms of the audience work relationship, how it sets
so.
Up the power dynamic. I think it is fairly in line with that kind of tradition. That there's an observation of a power dynamic in relative to change. That's my response is probably indicative of my lack of reading with regards to.
Actually brings me to almost like another question, and I'm sure that there are others here that can kind of speak to this. But I do wonder how this kind of activity, which all these frames that are set up by the works for sort of discussion or for sort of community. Connection as we are here engaging on Kate Newby's carpet work, which wasn't really sort of intended to be so much a platform as such, but it has sort of evolved this way as we're using it, don't we? I think she's always interested in how an action and we are acting. But brings up another question of whether how these works, if they are encouraging connection, how that doesn't become sort of co-opted by the institution, and therefore the sort of importance of that is then kind of made sort of. Signaling the process of being co-opted by being co-opted rather than presuming that you cannot be co-opted. So that's sort of about like Malone's, how he uses references.
I think it's just the condition of contemporary art. I think that, and that's why I think, I guess, why the work is less blunt.
To provide isolation from the surrounding space, insofar as it realizes that it comes as a significant energy cost. Is there a valid metaphor from that to the kinds of art and to the kinds of criticism as compared with the other alternative that's appearing now?
What would be the other alternative that you've used to have?
You use the word dialogue.
Oh, right.
I think that's an alternative to criticism. I don't know what the labels are around art, and I don't know what the labels are around space.
I think that raises a really interesting issue, because I think that the works in this exhibition are referencing the modernist gallery rather than the new museum. And then it was something that I picked up when I came in the exhibition and I was quite confused by. So this kind of languid process of unpacking is in part trying to work out why the dialogue moves with the white cube. Because I think the contemporary gallery design there's often an attempt to dissolve the division between the gallery space and the streetscape, or at least allow a lot of sight lines in through into the building. Like Zaha Hadid designed a building in Cincinnati where you can see what's happening in the gallery from the streetscape, which is orientated at these shafts in relationship to primary lines of access within the site. She's also avoided certain shapes of space which you dissociate with the white cube design. So I think there's, as the white cube was described by Odoherty, certain aspects of it have shifted. But in some ways, what's occurred is a new neutral. You change the geometry, maybe the colours, but at an ideological level, sometimes perhaps things are different. Might be a view of the interior, but it might not necessarily set up a different relationship to community.
Mm.
I don't know if that answers your question.
That was a very loose question.
Sorry. Even the letter, though, has obvious precedence to that time if you think of Hans Hacke's work. I think even the other dimensions of Fiona's work have precedence within the same period.
Mm.
So I think even though I'm sure she's working authentically, the result is that the individual components are still in dialogue with that tradition. But I think you're right that the fact that there is more than one unit does complicate the work and move it away from this individual piece.
Yeah, and it's just really interesting how we read it from our kind of contemporary, this sounds like a tautology, but our contemporary art historical context of, and also like an environmental or social kind of context that we're in now. We come to the work with so many different layers of contextual reading that just shifts it sort of completely away from the actual.
So does that mean many competing interpretations of what neutral is?
I guess that's indicative of contemporary artists' desire for their work to be more multi-dimensional and not able to be reduced to a clinical statement.
Yeah.
is the, so even though, which I think reinforces your point, but there's this kind of sense that they're attempting to construct their difference while still utilising the strategies that are of use to them that happen to come from this time. But I thought with this exhibition, that with the title, which I think initially gave me an impression of what the exhibition was going to be, and it was, and the works were different to what I thought would happen, because I thought the title suggested to me that the works would be proposing ways that art could operate that may not relate to the dominant image of what art is from previous periods. I wasn't expecting the work to be in such intimate dialogue with conceptual art strategies. But I think that's interesting because the future has ended up in quotation marks. It's almost like rather than the future is unwritten, it's that the future is overwritten.
I guess it's, the premise of this exhibition was to invite a series of artists to produce new works, but that the works would be proposals or propositions. I mean, it's kind of a question of how we conceive of time, because even though the civic image of Anne Shelton's photograph, Nostalgia for the Future, I mean, we can only base the idea of the future from the context that we are in now.
But I guess it's different to how the avant-garde artists were attempting to operate.
Right.
Through a process of negation,
the
trying to create an image which had some kind of novelty. So to operate in that way now, in a certain sense, would be nostalgic or retrograde. You end up in this situation, which is quite difficult.
It's almost like you don't have enough tensors.
Enough what?
Tensors.
Yeah.
I could be interested to have a quick wander around the exhibition to see if it triggers more questions. Is anyone else interested to do that? Installation quality where they can be permanent.
Absolutely. And and that's the other wonder and the dialogue that's come from this series of how these artists have engaged with this opportunity is that they have been in dialogue with people in the university. So Fiona is really, she's talked to facilities management, she's talked to environmental studies and brought in sort of experts both here, based at the university, but also sort of commercial system realizing this. that's just a little insight into how I guess I see that future, the future at play in this particular show. Did you have an expectation for you to produce something new?
Like in terms of the future? I was quite interested in the sort of utopian element of it and the kind of the shape of utopias and powers and forms, and it was quite structural.
Where she's suggesting sort of changes that relate to sustainability, how do you measure the effectiveness of it? Because as an artwork, do you measure its effectiveness in promoting the cause of sustainability and giving that prominence? So it's you're measuring it as a representation, or do you measure it in terms of its effectiveness at a more technical level?
Yeah, sure.
Because I just think of why you would do it as an artist as opposed to a political activist, and what art offers that
right.
you wouldn't get as a political activist.
That triggers
a bit more question in relation to this. Efficacy of
that
that's useful.
Yeah.
And maybe actually just.
So is this with your local consequences or remote consequences?
It has really triggered a few things for me with that question because I do think about how, some of these ideas, even if they're concepts, they're sculptural forms.
Mm.
And if we do put these on panels up on the roof, Fiona will see them as material form.
Mm.
It also makes me think about how a lot of the work in the show, particularly Martin Reynolds' project, is denying the expectation to show anything visual.
Mm.
But then there are, Peter's work is just visible an incredibly visual experience.
Mm.
So there's kind of, here we are on this very red, reflecting palette. So I think that the visual is celebrated.
Mm.
But more as a point, I think that it's not saying that that the meaning is embodied within, that that kind of point is to this or amplifying the space. I'm running away. I think it's really important to invite artists to be part of helping to write policy or to be undertaking research that can be incorporated into how we kind of function within institutions or council run spaces
I think that raises the issue of how you define sustainability, because it's not necessarily a purely technical issue. When we think about cultural sustainability, and perhaps maybe that's at the level that others are able to have more input. Like you may have something which is energy efficient, but no one wants it because it's so horrendous and alienating to the culture. Whereas if you kind of make something which happens to be efficient at a technical level, but also is appealing and enlightening for the culture, then ultimately it will be more sustainable.
Sure.
So I think it's just thinking about what it would mean for us being dialogue with these issues. It's not necessarily always at the kind of technical level.
There need to be cultural solutions as well as technological.
production is slightly valid. I would think that beauty and consumption are definitely substitutes for each other.
Nothing wrong with beauty, but a bit of visual spectacle, you know.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be traditional beauty, but
something that brings joy and shouldn't be kind of, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it's still kind of fraught with a lot of, I mean, politics and aesthetics is difficult and messy and complex. And so being able to use it effectively.
For a place where they can get a political satire.
I think that's interesting in relationship to how the anti-aesthetic has been appropriated by fashion and advertising, because it's become beautiful because of the manipulation.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, that's, you know, and aesthetics are as subjective as politics.
Mm.
I guess it's a shifting line.
Mm. Mm.
Like,
make
something beautiful.
And I think that it's maybe beautiful in a fashion sense because of the positive associations, the idea of risk, but in a kind of cleaned up way.
Yeah.
So as an artist, if you draw on this kind of legacy of an aesthetic, it doesn't have that edge anymore because it's been so co-opted.
Yeah.
But what are you left with? Which I guess is why people like Felix Gonzalez Torres were using sentimentality. Bringing in something which was a kind of debased beauty and then trying to reorientate it within the practice.
I think subjectivity operates as a good kind of neutralizer for a lot of kind of difficult aesthetics and politics. Like, it's the thing that kind of shuts down a lot of the readings about commodification or can help a work become non-preachy, like, you know, kind of building in something that's subjective or personal but also speaks on an essential level.
Mm.
And a lot of times kind of autobiography and work like that, I think it has a way of kind of tempering what aesthetic or political issues lay in the work, because you understand it from a personal perspective rather than reading it as something that's telling you.
Sort of unfolded some of your research in that particular
Thank you.
Thank you so much.